This is probably the fourth time in my some 35 years that I've done a sermon entitled something having to do with being a fool, and they're all different, so if you heard the last one, you're not going to get it again word for word. If you want to see an approximation, go to the bulletin board, and it's an article in today's LA Daily News. And they sought me out because finally, you know, I write and I teach and I preach about politics, about religion, about history. I pontificate about what's going on in the world. And frankly, most of the time, I'm out of my depth. But on being a fool, I am well qualified. And I think that there were very few people who would gainsay me on that. I asserted my right to be a fool really at the beginning of my career. Yeah, that's actually literally true. When I was ordained and empowered many years ago, Bob Kimball, who was the president of Star King School for the Liberal Ministry up in Berkeley, charged me with being another Paul, referencing my Jewish heritage, and he did the whole thing based on Saul Paul. And I got up there, and I'm probably the only person who was ever charged and ordained who had an argument with the person that did it. And I immediately took him on and said, I don't want to be a prophet. They end really badly. You know, the only good part about being a prophet is you really don't have to pay into the retirement plan, because it's just not going to pay off, because you're not going to be old and it's not going to be in natural causes. So you don't have to worry about your HMO. I said, I don't want to be a prophet. Paul, as I remember, at that point, just being a recent graduate, I'd only seen the movie and not read the book. I said, you know, I'd much rather be a fool. I'd much rather be a jester. Fools and jesters, like prophets, have the same basic job, and that is to speak truth to power. The difference is in life expectancy. The fool tries to coat it in sugar and honey with the vinegar underneath sometimes, and sometimes with the vinegar on top, to make the point, to bypass the censors, because one of the reasons that the jester and the fool get to live is they get laughter. And then you have to deal with the fact that you laugh. Laughter is subversive. Humor is subversive because it bypasses the censors. When somebody gives you a rational argument and you don't agree with it even before the argument started, you're in there filtering. You're saying, what's wrong? What's my response going to be? How can I put this how can I top them? How can I refute them? How can I keep their passion and their information out? When somebody gives it to you in humor and you laugh, you're stuck because you've had a visceral reaction. Something happened, and you may hate yourself in the morning, as I did after the campfire scene in Blazing Saddles, when I couldn't believe that I laughed at that. But I did, and I had to deal with it. And when you're doing it in political humor, you get it, you laugh, and you have to deal with it. And that happens to me all the time. I'll hear a comic say something that I find politically offensive, religiously offensive. But if I've laughed, I have to look at what it was that touched me and what it was that moved me. It is a form of education and argument that is very important to the world. And I think that we tolerate foolishness but underrate our great fools who speak simple truths. The idea of the holy fool is one that is also resonant in Western history and actually throughout history of all the cultures that I'm familiar with. The idea that there are people with really big brains who make it so confused and so complicated that you can't understand anything, and that there are simple people who cut to the chase and get what it's about. Now, I'm not going to make a know-nothing argument that it's better to be dumb and ill-informed, because that's a low bar, and I don't believe that it's true. But it is sometimes good to sweep away some of the complications that we make with our big brains. I remember back at Studio City giving a really remarkably sophomoric sermon on what we should do about world hunger, and I was off talking about how, well, you know, if we send food, then people are just going to live to reproduce, to create more death and not more life. And there is an argument that can be structured. But when we got to that famous, where are you? Over there. Talk back. Ethel, who was sitting over there, said, well, John, if you've got food today and they're hungry today, why don't you just do the right thing today and give them food? So I went back up to the pulpit and I picked up my manuscript and I said, listen to Ethel. What I said wasn't as a fool. What I said was just foolish. I had made it too complicated. There's a wonderful Hasidic story about the wise the wise guys in the little temple and the little shtetl who are laughing because they hear the janitor. And the janitor is just reciting his ABCs, his Aleph Beis. And they say, look at this idiot. He's just reciting the alphabet. He doesn't know the prayers. And the wise chassid, the pious rabbi, said to his disciples, no, you've got it backwards. You are memorizing formulas, and you have thought all of this out, and you feel so superior. He trusts God to put the letters in the order that they need to be in. His is the act of true faith and submission. Now, I don't want you to take that theologically literally, but the idea of letting go of some of our preconceptions and cutting to the chase of life instead of being so complicated and paralyzed by all of the various possibilities and arguments. If you watch political shows, you understand that an argument can be made. An argument can be made by a gifted sophist about anything. How do we discern our truths? It's interesting to me, and I hope to you, that Spinoza talks about how the forms of knowledge are opinion, reason, but the highest form is intuition. Now, that doesn't mean guessing. That means the kind of knowledge that strikes you and you get it and you go, yeah, that fits. That fits who I am and what it is that is at the essence of my sense of ethics and morality. It's so interesting how dates fall and I don't plan them, and the song, the choral anthem of I believe in sunlight in the darkness, when I believe in the light even when the sun isn't shining, and it recalls to me a story that was already in my sermon, and that is I was on a caravan across the Sahara Desert on a very uncomfortable three-legged camel that was torturing me. But I was talking to my guide, and we were talking about the meaning of life. And I wanted to make it a philosophical question, and he wouldn't accept it as a philosophical question. He said, the meaning of life is life. The meaning of life is not the abstractions. You can't see the meaning of life with your busy, noisy life in the city. And he knew cities in North Africa, had no idea what a noisy, busy, ambient light kind of world there is in Chicago or New York or our major cities. A small city was a major source of noise for him. But he said, out in the desert, we can see the stars. We can see stars that you don't know exist in your busy, backlit lives and world. We can be in touch with who we are as human beings and what the elemental forces of life are, what the dangers are, what the opportunities are, what is truly precious in our lives. And it isn't about the abstract question of what is the meaning of life. It is about, how am I going to live this day? How am I going to do and plan and enjoy and take in the light, the darkness, the warmth, the cold, the sun, the stars, wives, husbands, cousins, family, children, take care of the animals, and get from one oasis to another? Because the meaning of life is in the journey for him, for Sisala, from one oasis across a desert to another. I thought that was powerful. And it took me and takes me today right to the Passover story that we also begin to celebrate tomorrow night. And that is a story of going not from an oasis to an oasis, but from a river to a river. From the west where the sun sets and slavery and death, and a journey out towards the light, across a desert, across water, to another river, one where the people who left Egypt could not enter, but they left and they suffered and they rebelled and they revolted and they gave birth to another generation who could enter that land. And it's so clearly a metaphor for everyone's individual life. And it's a powerful metaphor because it isn't a question of, well, why did they leave? I mean, Egypt wasn't that bad. In fact, the Bible says they regretted the flesh pots of Egypt. But they left in order to have a better world for their children. And the lesson, the truth of it, is not in the fact. It's not, did the Exodus happen as described? It is the truth in, we work, and we wander, and we sometimes go astray, but we do it for the sake of a future. We may make choices that seem foolish. When Moses came to the people in slavery and said, well, why don't we get up, get out of Egypt, and go wander in the desert, the focus groups did not come back very positive. Moses got an argument. It's a tradition. It's a family tradition. Moses got an argument. And even after the Red Sea parted, even after they got manna from heaven, Moses still got an argument. After he went up to Sinai, they built the golden calf. There were still arguments going on about, what are we doing out here? Only a fool would leave the safety of the known to go wander in a desert. But only a fool can change slavery to freedom. Only a fool can make a difference for the next generation. Only a fool believes enough in life to risk life, to make choices that are against the parimutuel odds, the actuarial tables. April Fools and Palm Sunday on the same day. Well, there's, that sounds like a dangerous introductory topic sentence, doesn't it? But I don't think so. It really tells you about the foolishness of how a public acts and reacts. Right now, almost all of the United States is caught up in the horse race. I'm tempted to make a dirty pun on that because of the amount of fundraising necessary to fund this horse's race. The horse race for president. We're listening to the polls, the snapshots of what's going on. Meaningless. Meaningless. Palm Sunday. The message of Palm Sunday seems so clear to me. You can be welcomed with hosannas and with palms and be given a parade and rejected the next day. You can be rejected one day and welcomed on another day. It's not permanent. Everyone gets thrown down into the slough of despond, into the pit, into the tomb, into the sepulcher, and there are opportunities to climb out. The status of permanency, as long as we live, is not permanent. It's transient. Palm Sunday says, don't take all the hosannas too literally, because they may not last, nor take rejection too seriously, because that might not last either. Where there is life, there is, in fact, hope. The odds against anything are overwhelming. What are the parimutuel odds against being here? I mean, you don't need to be religious to have a deep appreciation of the mystery of existence, the mystery of life. You don't have to reject physics and science to have an appreciation and wonder that something exists where it could be nothing. Of course, we'd have a hard time appreciating it if it were in fact nothing. That something exists, that the world exists, that the universe exists, that we are alive in it, and that we all won the lottery. We all won the lottery because we're alive and we're human, and we feel, and we cry, and we laugh, and we hope, and we despair. But we won the lottery, and we won the lottery because of where we are and how we are just individually here and in this community. And it is just remarkable, and the odds are hugely against any of those events when you take into consideration all of the matter in the universe. What are the odds of some guy raised in Egypt leading the Israelites to freedom, of a carpenter at the edge of the Roman Empire being remembered 2,000 years later, of an unlettered prophet in the Arabian Peninsula being one of the great social cultural forces in the world today? What were the parimutuel odds against Rosa Parks when she sat down and by sitting made tumble the vicious dominoes of de jure segregation? What are the parimutuel odds against all of the good and the bad things that are offered to us and our ability to make some difference? We don't know that it will be decisive. We don't know that when we do the right thing by our own lights, it will lead to grand consequences. We can be pretty sure if we do nothing, it will lead nowhere. So we can be fools. We can be fools and tilt at windmills. We can be fools and sit down to block things that need to be blocked, to stand up for values that we need to stand up for as individuals and as communities. It doesn't mean we have to have a sense of success. It doesn't mean we have to have a sense that we shouldn't be questioned. But we should have a sense of the authenticity of our choices and of our actions. We all have the opportunity to be foolish. We all have the opportunity to be fools. And I urge all of us to look inside and do our best to be authentic fools, throwing out the actuarial tables, cutting through the dross and the argument and the sophistry to the issues of our deepest held values and how we want this brief flash of light between eternities of darkness that is life to affect tomorrow, the next generation, our children, and our children's children. I believe in engaging life with an open, optimistic, humble, and foolish heart. And these foolish things, I believe, lead us to doing modest good that might be great good if enough fools believe.